My guest tonight at the big table is no stranger to WGN Radio. Chicago Tribune columnist Eric Zorn can be heard regularly on Bill and Wendy, as well as the John Williams podcast, a great podcast, The Mincing Rascals. But it's in the paper and on the Trib site where most people know the name Eric Zorn. Zorn just celebrated his 30th anniversary as a columnist with the Tribune. It started out as a career writing about the suburbs, and it's turned into one of the best news blogs in the business. From stories about Rolando Cruz to Rod Blagojevich to interpreting the day's current events, Eric can do it all. Tonight, we talk about what it takes to write a column in Chicago, transitioning to new platforms, and the stories that make the city. Eric Zorn, welcome to Big Table.
Thanks, Justin. You said that I celebrated 30 years, but weren't you also celebrating my 30 years? I mean, I guess I'm doing it for you. Some other people were celebrating, or was it just me, lonely me celebrating?
I think it was just you. You know,
I was observing 30 years.
Well, so. I mean, there was some fanfare for it. You wrote a piece, and then I think there
generated the fanfare. Yeah, but, yes.
The reader did a piece. Mike Minor did a piece about it. You know, let's go back to that time. I mean, 30 years. It's amazing to think that you've been writing about Chicago, for Chicagoans, and that includes the suburbs, for such a long time. What was Chicago like 30 years ago?
Well, Abe Montgomery Burns and I hung out on the lakefront and said, someday there will be a park here. No, I mean, Chicago has obviously built up. The thing that has changed the most right around here is that, you know, back behind the Tribune Tower, between here and the lake, it was just like warehouses, basically, and this whole development back here. But, you know, I would say that it's pretty much the same, still have the same city-suburban divide, you know, the violence ebbs and flows, but you know, back then, of course, you know, when I started writing a column, Harold Washington was the mayor here, and I was mostly writing about the suburbs, as you pointed out.
Yeah.
And you know, then we had all those years of Daley, and you know, essentially, you know, the fundamental character of Chicago hasn't changed.
How did that help you to start your career writing about the suburbs?
Well, I really hated the idea at first. When they sent me out to the suburbs, I just had a fit. You know, I started looking around for other places I could work. I was flirting with other, you know, cities. Oh, do you want a Metro columnist? And you know, and they, you know, it just felt like being exiled to nowhere at the time. And I went really reluctantly, under the, you know, understanding that I had been a feature writer. I wrote for a section called Tempo. You may remember Tempo.
Of course, yeah.
And I had done a lot of features, a lot of long pieces there. And they said, you know, we want you to get some news writing chops. You know, go out and cover bus crashes and trials and fires and things like that. And I thought, yeah, I didn't need to do that. And anyway, so they sent me out there. And it was a great experience. First of all, I worked with some really amazing people who were out there also. What they did at the time was they just sent basically a lot of young reporters out to the suburbs to do exactly what I'm talking about, just to kind of, you know, figure out how to cover a courthouse, how to cover a police station, and then they brought them into the
city. And this is sort of before the idea of the hyperlocal,
not the hyperlocal, although it was one of the many suburban expansions that the Tribune has tried over the years. There was a thing called Suburban Trib, which is, you know, getting on 40 years ago now, and then that closed, and then we said, well, but there's still this audience. There's a lot of readers out there, a lot of advertisers out there. So when I was out there, this was part of an expansion that we were doing. Sort of, it was basically suburban zoning. We had a DuPage edition, we had Lake County editions,
right.
We had South Suburban editions, and the idea was we would localize, but not hyper local. We didn't do like town by town, but we did region by region. And it was, you know, it was really fun, and they gave me a lot of room to write at the time. And they said at the time there was a column in the New York Times called Our Towns, written by Bill Geist, the father of Willie Geist, who's on Morning Joe, if anyone who's keeping media score there. But Bill wrote this column, he had written it for the Suburban Trib, and then he's writing it for the New York Times. And it was basically covering the suburbs and finding like all the interesting people, all the interesting little issues out there that develop. And they said, you know, go do something like that. And so they gave me this column. This was 1986. They said, and you know, I was going out and I was just finding all the, you know, the guy on the corner selling birdhouses and stuff like that.
It had to do wonders for the idea of what you would become, a general interest metro sort of columnist for the Tribune, because you get to know these communities. You get to know not just the geography of our area, but you know what kind of people, what their values are. You understand a little bit more about the region that is reading your column.
Oh, yeah, that's definitely true. And it's one thing that the job I have now doesn't put me as in touch with people. Social media and email and the immediacy of the contact with readers has replaced some of that actual, like, shoe leather reporting, as you know, when you're talking about how you get to know people, how you get to know how people are thinking and so on. It used to be, you know, I would get what we call snail mail and voicemail people would call, but there wasn't the same level of interaction. You know, someone would write you a letter, you'd write back, and maybe that was it. Email now, you can go many rounds with people. You get, you know, in Facebook disputes and so on. So there was, so that's a way of keeping touch. Back then, it was literally, you know, I was putting 10, 20,000 miles a year in my car, going out to all these communities, covering like their little, you know, suburban dust ups that they would have. You know, the library board is fighting with the park district and so on. But they were interesting, and you really get to see, you know, the animating spirit of politics at its local nastiest best. You know, so it was a really great education in journalism, and it was also such an opportunity to do stories and bring stories to light that other people weren't covering, or I should say, were being covered in some of these small papers. And so what I would often do is I would read, you know, the Hinsdale doings, and I would find some interesting little story that's going on out there that they were covering, and then just come and re-report it and do it. So it was, like I said, it was a really fun time, really interesting time. And they gradually took, they called that column Hometowns after the Our Towns column. And over the years, they ended up taking that moniker off the column and putting my name on it. So it became my column. And the thing that really changed for me, the thing that really made my life a lot better and sort of took me out of this pigeonhole that I was in was when Mary Schmidt came to town. Mm-hmm. And Mary was our Atlanta correspondent for the Tribune. And she was very, very well regarded, as she should be. And they wanted her to come up here and write a column that Barbara Brotman had been doing. All these names, I hope that people are recognizing this. Barbara had been writing a column for the Metro section about wacky, weird, interesting people in the city.
In the city, right.
And Barbara decided she wanted off that, and she went off and took some other directions. This was, you know, it was her decision, and they wanted to replace her, and they tried a few people, and finally they said, let's bring Mary back from Atlanta. And Mary said, well, you know, I'm not going to come back and write feature stories again. I said, I've done a lot of feature stories. I want a real column. I want to be able to write about, you know, I want to write what I'm thinking about. I want to write my opinion and so on. And they said, okay, fine. So when she came back and they gave her that portfolio, they didn't give it to me necessarily, but I was writing opposite her. And I felt like any time if they, you know, called me, I'm like, well, isn't this a little bit beyond your, I would say, well, wait, this is not fair. You can't treat me different than Mary. You can't. So Mary like opened
this
door.
Yeah.
She really did, you know. And the funny thing is that Mary still is more of a feature writer than I am. She gets out there and does exactly these stories a lot more than I do. I'm the guy, you know, sitting on my high horse on the fourth floor, wagging my finger at politicians and people and ne'er-do-wells. And Mary is the one who's still, is touching those bases. But that was really, she was really the one who liberated me from the you're the guy who does the strange people and odd controversies in the suburbs. And that was the early 90s. And so since then, the idea that I write a suburban column, that went away.
That went away.
And so I was able to.
Well, let's take a quick break. And we're talking with Eric Zorn, the longtime columnist at Chicago Tribune, just celebrated 30 years as a columnist for the paper. Let's talk about the 90s. I mean, those are the big years for you, especially when it comes to some of the big stories here in Chicago, and specifically Rolando Cruz. And we'll talk more about sort of the stories that you remember, the ones that Chicago remembers here on The Download. Eric Zorn, my guest at the big table. Stay with us. It's The Download here on 720 WGN. Eric Zorn, my guest at the big table tonight, the long-standing columnist for the Chicago Tribune. Just celebrated 30 years in the fall. Finally got you in here. It took a while.
I'm in great demand, Justin.
You are in such demand. You can hear Eric weekly, Bill and Wendy. Is it Mondays that you do?
On Mondays at 11:30 with them, yeah. Yep. And then we do the Mincing Rascals podcast.
Which is so great. It's such a great podcast.
Oh, thanks. We record that Thursday mornings, and then as soon as they can put it out there, they post it online.
That's great.
It's been a lot of fun doing that.
We talked about, you know, the column, and we were just kind of talking in the break about, you know, I feel like I have a connection to Chicago's news and Chicago's history with the news because of the columnists that write about the stories. And we're going to talk about Rolando Cruz. And I think of other stories. Think of, you know, Baby T and Bob Green. I think of even some of the sports, you know, columns. You're connected to the news in Chicago based on the writings of the columnists. And I really truly believe that. I mean, there's a lot of great, unbelievable feature reporting that's done in this town, and it's done from the papers, always has been. But the columnists are the one that continue the story. They continue to have sort of the narrative.
Yeah, I'd like to think that's true, that what we do is we'll take a story, and because we write in shorter bits, you know, you look at a column, and no matter what you think of the columnist, it never looks too daunting to read it, right? It's 700 words, maybe 900 words on a particularly wordy day. But it's bite-sized and often, and usually somewhat conversational. They're leading you, and they don't assume that you know everything already. It's not written in that, you know, inverted pyramid style. So I like to think that a column is an accessible way into the news. And I've written a number of columns over the years where I try simply to explain some of these issues that get talked about a lot, but we never really like dig way down into them. Like this whole issue, just for example, of the school funding disparities, the disparity between the pensions in the suburbs, the teacher pensions in the suburbs in the city, yeah. Just like trying to break that. And how did that get started? When did it get started? Why is it that way? How much does it cost the city? How much does it cost the suburbs? You know, just to try to do that in a, you know, like a Q&A format, other different ways that you don't do see you, news stories.
Do you feel like that's your responsibility?
No, it's what I try to do. It's one of these things. When you're a columnist in Chicago, particularly now, you know, there's so much interesting stuff going on in the state, the city, the national government, you know, all kinds of stuff going on, that you have to write the column that you would want to read, essentially. So a lot of times if you'll see me writing about something, it's because I've decided I wanted to know that. I wanted to read that. So since no one else is going to write it, I'm going to have to write it so I can read it the next morning, kind of. I mean, that kind of approach. You have to really focus on what it is that you're thinking about. And Mary and I, Shamik and I, talk a lot about, you know, what are you going to write about next? And we sort of will kick ideas around. But usually with the thing that you have to go with is what you're actually thinking about, what's actually animating you. Don't try to figure out what you should be writing about. Don't say, like, I should explain to people something that I don't care that much about. That's a recipe for really tedious columns.
Well, I think about the story of Rolando Cruz and how that played out. You wrote about it extensively. You continued to cover it. Is there a time that, especially in a day and age before there was social media and people could tell you one way or another immediately what they think, that and even, you know, reading some of the stuff about it, there were editorial pages, others that were saying, enough, Eric. That's too many columns on Rolando Cruz. You're beating a dead horse on this.
There were editors saying that. Actually.
So I mean, how do you know when to continue the story? I mean,
that's a really good question. I'm thinking that there might be some people listening who don't remember the Rolando Cruz story.
As a good columnist,
there might
us
be
up,
some people. It's hard to believe. I mean, your audience is very
knowledgeable. Give us the.
But yeah. the really short story is that in the early '80s, the young girl Janina Carrico was abducted from her home in Naperville and was found several days later. She'd been raped and murdered. Terrible story. It was a shattering story. It would be a shattering story at any time. This parents' nightmare, girls home alone, sick from school and everything. By and by, these three mopes from Aurora got arrested, these three, you know, kind of petty criminal type guys. One of them was Rolando Cruz. And they were, you know, investigated and tried and convicted. Two of them were convicted. One was not. And essentially, you know, the evidence that they had against him was really thin. And I got into this about, I think, when did I get into it? The early 90s, I think, is when I got into it. The crime had happened in 83, as I remember. And in the course of all these appeals, what had happened was that another suspect, a man named Brian Dugan, had arisen after these guys had been convicted. And Brian Dugan's, the early DNA test matched him on the victim's body. But of course it wasn't the, you know, 1 in 10,000 DNA. It was like 1 in 6 DNA kind of stuff that it also matched. I think it was Cruz. But you know, the story that they told, that the authorities told, just to make a sort of a really long story. I mean, there've been books written about it.
Yes,
a great long story short is that ultimately, it really looked like this had been a railroad job, that these guys, that the investigators and prosecutors out there had, at some point along the way, they'd realize, well, we might have the wrong guys, but we can't admit that. So they just kept going after these original guys. Cruz was on death row when I first met him. And, you know, just chasing after these guys, even though there was substantial evidence that another man had committed the crime. I began doing the case because I had written a column It was right about the time that John Wayne Gacy was executed, so we could actually date that. I did a column, and my opinion on the death penalty is not that it's this horrible thing, that it, you know, how dare we take a life. My opinion on the death penalty is that we too often have the wrong people on death row. We too often execute people who might be innocent. And it's not that this is a huge problem. I mean, it's not like there's hundreds of people like that, but there are enough of them that you have to ask yourself, well, what's the payoff? And when you look at the payoff, there's really nothing. The death penalty doesn't reduce crime. It doesn't deter murder. It costs a ton of money to do these capital trials. So I have sort of this pragmatic opposition to the death penalty. So I wrote a column basically saying, you know, Gacy, you know, fine, light a candle for him if you want. But when you think about the death penalty, think of people like Rolando Cruz. And I had seen, there had been pieces about him. There had been the Chicago Lawyer had done some wonderful stuff on it. 60 Minutes had done a piece on it. It was not like an unknown case. But think about people like Rolando Cruz, you know, people who are plausibly innocent who are still on death row. That's what the problem with the death penalty. Yeah. And I got a call from one of his attorneys. And he said, would you like to look a little bit deeper into this case? And I said, yeah, sure, okay. And, you know, literally a couple hours later, he's on my front porch on the northwest side with like four or five banker's boxes. He's just like, you know, here, you know.
You can have these.
And I started reading the trial transcripts and all the investigative reports, and it was the most compelling, infuriating story that I'd ever heard. So I started writing columns about it.
Well, columnist Eric Zorn is my guest at the big table. Let's take a quick break so we can get the update on tonight's news with Rob Martyr. And we'll pick that story up because there's a lot more than just someone who's innocent who's on death row. I mean, there's political ambitions involved. The state's attorney at the time, or the
DuPage County state's attorney at the time of some of the prosecution was Jim Ryan. Yeah. So
I mean, it really does. I mean, it ties up into a really sort of unique Illinois story.
Yeah.
Eric Zorn, my guest tonight at the big table. We're talking about 30 years of his column in the Chicago Tribune. We'll take a quick break. We'll get the news. We'll come back. We'll continue the conversation. Stay with us. We're playing the funky music tonight to commemorate 30 years. Right, Eric?
That's exactly right. That's the music I played at my 30-year column anniversary party.
When you got your free, yeah, when
we
you
danced, we drank. And after that, there's, you know, no memory at all of what happened.
Eric Zorn, the longtime Chicago Tribune columnist, just celebrated an anniversary, 30 years writing the column for the Chicago Tribune. You know, as we were talking right before the break, just about following a story. Rolando Cruz, we set it up. You continue to follow that story, even when editors are saying, enough, Eric.
Well, what I did with that story was, at first I wrote like a series of 15 columns, like laying out the case and laying out what I thought were the holes in it and sort of telling it in chronological order, saying this is what happened and thundering at the end of each one, like this is really unthinkable that this guy's on death row. And after about 15 columns, my editor called me in.
And this is before internet, by the way. So
this is before the internet. Yeah, paper, so it's like right? in some ways, these columns are just going out into the void, which is an interesting change that we've had.
Yeah,
that it
right?
used to be, Roger Ebert put it this way once, because it used to be that we would like basically stand up on the metaphorical hill shouting down to the peasants with our megaphone. And that is not the way it works
right.
anymore.
And we'll get into
you know,
that.
They
right,
shout right,
right.
right back. But then I was just like sending these things out here. My editor called me in. And he said, you know, he said, I love these columns. I am totally convinced. He says, anybody who's read these columns carefully has got to be convinced. But I'll tell you, anybody who is not convinced by these columns is never going to be convinced. So when are you going to wrap this
Move on,
up?
Yeah. Right.
And I said, well, I had like two more. And he said, fine. Good. That's good. Because I think, you know, you want to move on to other things. But he wasn't angry, but he's just saying that you don't want to be a flagpole sitter, right? I'm going to keep writing about this.
Right.
And, you know, I think that's what happened with some of these other columns you were mentioning, some, you know, like Bob Green writing about Baby Richard and Baby T and Sarah and these kids that he'd write about. He would write about them over and over and over again until people were just like, you know,
yeah.
enough of this. You're not giving us enough new stuff. On the other hand, you know, he was able to generate a lot of anger and enthusiasm for it. I took a break then from those columns, but the story kept evolving. He was on death row then, and then he got off death row because the Supreme Court overturned the verdict at his trial. He had a new trial coming, and so I was able to get into all those issues. So I ended up writing about 100 columns, and they never told me to stop at that point because I wasn't writing them every day. I was writing one every couple of weeks. I'd do an update, catching people up on it, and then I was able to cover the trial where he was acquitted halfway through. And then I even, following this all up, Brian Dugan, we mentioned him earlier, he was the guy whose DNA was found. The new advanced DNA tests came back and showed that he was, one in 100,000 people who could have left the DNA material in the girl, and he was convicted.
It's Chicago's, what was the movie that we just had, the Catholic Church movie, the one from Boston, Spotlight. In a way, Rolando Cruz is in that same category where a newspaper columnist, a newspaper picked up the story and made it something, because that story could have gone away. And many stories like that have gone away. So that's when I go back to the question about, do you feel like it's your responsibility?
Yeah, well, what happened with that case, that was really one of the leading edge stories in a whole series of wrongful conviction cases that got exposed and written about by me, but by other journalists too. We had some great investigators at the Tribune who took on the death penalty. After I had done these series on Cruz, they took up and they did some really deep dives into the problems with false confessions and with bogus experts and with jailhouse confessions and so on. All the jailhouse snitches, all these things that infect the criminal justice system. Some great criminal justice reporting. They should have won the Pulitzer. We ended up winning a Pulitzer for editorials that were written about all this, but not for that work itself. But it's a kind of story that really involves all kinds of aspects of society that we count on, that we trust, and I'm really proud of the work that a lot of people did, not just me, in this. And I say with the Cruz case, one thing that I said is like, I feel like I get a lot of credit for that, but I'm like the football player that jumped on the quarterback after the other guy had grabbed him by the ankle, the other guy grabbed him, and then I come and and leveled him, and then I got a lot of credit for it. But the guys who grabbed those ankles, there were a lot of people who really devoted a lot of time. There were journalists who got there before I did. I think he'd be, he would be free without me today. It's one of those things where you don't want to get, I'm so important, but it was such a great example, I thought, of how journalists can shine a light on things. And this is, of course, what motivated George Ryan, Governor Ryan, it wasn't this case in particular, but the accumulation of these cases.
It's a chapter in Chicago, Illinois history.
Yeah. It motivated him to declare a moratorium on the death penalty, which ended up in Governor Quinn signing a bill that abolished the death penalty in Illinois. So it all kind of traces back.
In your 30th anniversary, 30th, I guess you would say,
Jubilee is how
Jubilee,
I like to
be. Right. You talked about the idea of trust. And you talked about that sort of is at the foundation of what makes a good columnist. Why is trust the most important?
I think, my thought about that is that you don't want readers to agree with you at all times. In fact, I go back and look at some old columns. I don't agree with everything I've ever written. You want readers to believe that you have honestly come to the view that you've come to and that what you were telling them is what you really think. And it is not based on any other motivations. No one is paying you off. You're not trying just to agitate them. You're not just being a provocateur. This is something that that is heartfelt.
You put some thought into it.
You put a lot of thought into it, and so I don't. Like I say, my goal. I'm not trying to comfort readers. I'm not trying to say, look, this is don't we all agree on this? I realize and I know from a lot of the comments I get, the things that I write make people angry today. Just today, I wrote a column about WGN radio, and I got some mail from people telling me what a puke I am and how they can't wait for me to lose my job, and I get that, I understand that, and what I want people to believe and to know when they read me is that this is what I really think, and it's based on this is the best that I can do based on what I've learned, that I'm not, I'm not trying to advance any other agenda other than what I believe. So
do you feel as a columnist, especially in this day and age, this political age, and with the advent of social media and the ability to immediately respond to the work, has that changed the way you write?
When
Yeah, you know, I think it might have in some ways. It certainly changes what I write about, because I can, one thing that I do is, and you may do this in radio too, I don't know, is I'll, sometimes I'll have a thought and I'll put it on Facebook, you know, and I'll just say, you know, everyone ever noticed this? And sometimes people will grab those thoughts and they'll get like 90, 100 comments. People will really get involved and they'll think, well, that's a column. That's right. I should write about that. I'll have to expand that into a column. And other times I'll have something that I'll think is a great idea, like, oh, this is some, you know, because I realize that, you know, I'm as idiosyncratic as the next person, and I'll have thoughts about things that no one else is interested in. I can be like the guy at the dinner party who goes like, hey, anyone ever notice this? And people look at you like, so, but, and so that, so you can use, and this is, you mentioned the blog earlier.
Yeah.
And I was like the first blogger at the Tribune. And I used the blog. I referred to it as an incubator. And at the time, and I started writing a blog in 2003 when it was a fairly new medium. And this was before Facebook. So, I mean, Facebook kind of gave everybody a blog in a way. And Facebook, you know, gave everybody an incubator for their ideas. But back then, you know, when you were doing a blog, you were like pushing it out to people. And I would take like one or two paragraphs and put it out there. And I would see what, if I would get people to write back, get people excited about it. And that would often inform, you know, what people would want to read, you know, because I have like 10 or 15 thoughts every day, you know, about things that I could write about, but choosing the right one is always the hard part.
I was ending tonight with the idea of, I mean, the transition of platform, you know, for you to be able to go from being a print columnist to be able to get that in the Sunday paper or the Monday, whatever, to transitioning to a platform on a website where you're writing every day. I mean, you learned a lot of the lessons, valuable lessons, that a lot of journalists were coming to terms with early in the transition to the internet. And one is volume, one is quality. I mean, there's a lot that goes in, and you've seen a lot of news bloggers come and go, but Eric Zorin remains.
Well, I do, except that, you know, one of the things, we had a platform change at the Tribune where I was writing on, I mean, this is like tech talk, but I was writing on a certain kind of blogging platform that was unique to blogging. And then we transitioned to a whole new composition presentation program online, and it made the way I interact with readers in the blog very different. And it turned that interaction that I so valued into something that I couldn't handle anymore, because I didn't have the editorial control. When I first had the blog, I had this comment thread, and I would go in and it was almost like a talk radio show in a way. I mean, and people who talk about blogging in the early days spoke about it as almost like a radio show. You'd have a host,
right,
and then people would respond, and the host would interact with the people responding. Well, I lost that ability, and that took away the impetus for me to have that kind of, those kind of conversations in that blog format. A lot of that energy for me has gone over to Facebook and Twitter. I still use the blog to put things up. I put something up today about single-payer health care. There are five Democratic congressmen in Illinois who are not supporting single payer. There are five who are, five who aren't. And I asked all five of them, why aren't you supporting this? Because it seems like such a strong, and that wasn't a column. It'll probably turn into a column later, or the genesis of a column, but I wanted to get that out there. But there isn't that same level of interaction on the blog. But again, I think social media,
that's the lifeblood, right? But social media took that.
Social media does take that place, because it really has become, you know, I spoke a few minutes ago about, you know, the idea of the columnist of days of yore being the guy up on the hill with his megaphone telling the people what to think. And now it's more like the person who's down among you trying to start the conversation and guide the conversation and give you something to think about. And again, it's not like, a column, to my mind, maybe a column used to be like trying to end an argument, and now it's trying to set the table for an argument, trying to move an argument along, trying to move a discussion along. Because you know, those, the days of that authority figure, the days of that person who's like, this is the way it is, I think those days are kind of gone.
You know, I always think about columnists as the early bloggers, and we've had this conversation.
Yeah.
But, you know, the Tribune, when it was a newspaper only, would have columnists with political diversity, you know, regional diversity, what just the idea that they had something for everybody. As you evolve as columnists and you become a columnist for the online platform, chicagotribune.com, do you run the risk of sort of writing to a vacuum, where the only people that will read Eric Zorn are people that agree with Eric Zorn. A conservative reader is not going to even take part. Before it used to be the paper and you'd read all of them together, but now you've sort of a la carte'd it.
A vacuum. I don't like that word. I do think that maybe a better word is like
bubble.
A silo.
Bubble.
A bubble
silo.
Or a
yeah.
silo.
Sorry, right.
Yes, and that is definitely something that you see where, you know, you have people who follow you who are local and people who follow you like around, I have people who follow me from around the country. And it does tend to become sort of ideologically centered where you get, the people who are following you and giving you the feedback, writing you emails. I mean, I get a lot of criticism, but there is this sense that that you are ending up existing in this silo.
I mean, it was designed more as a newspaper columnist. They had different viewpoints.
Right.
And so you're in a paper and you can read John Cass and then read Eric Zorn and you sort of walk away going, oh,
right.
But I don't know if it works that way.
I don't like to think, I don't like to think of myself as totally predictable on all these issues. And I don't like to think of myself as rigidly, liberal or left wing. I really admire Steve Chapman, who's on our staff, who is always surprising me. He's always, he's someone who is in sort of constant intellectual evolution, brilliant writer and brilliant thinker. And again, someone who was like, well, come out an issue, you think like, you can't really tell me, how is Steve Chapman going to write about this? What's he going to say about this? I just don't know. When he dopes his columns with us, I'm on the little email list, he'll say like, I'm going to write about, this. And I'll like say, I wonder what he's going to say versus other people who I know what they're going to say. Right. I mean, maybe people know a little bit more what I'm going to say, but yeah, there is that you don't want to ever be pigeonholed.
Do you bristle at the idea when someone will go on Twitter or someone comments like the liberal Eric Zorn?
I own that. And I'm proud of being a liberal. And I think liberalism has a lot to be proud of. It's got some things to be ashamed of, and there's no question about it. But I'm proud to say I'm liberal or progressive. I think that's an important political philosophy, and I think that there's a lot, when you look back in the last 100 years, that we have accomplished moving forward with women's rights, minority rights, gay rights, all those things, environmental protections, all the things that I think liberals can be justifiably proud of. But I also want to say that I do like to think that I recognize the excesses of liberalism and I see where it's gone wrong in places. And I'm always open. The other thing is that just as a sort of citizen of the media communities, you always want to keep an open mind about things. You don't want to have a knee jerk reaction to any issue. You want to sort of think things through. You want to be able to change your mind about things. And that's, actually the death penalty is an issue on which I did change my mind because I was kind of for the death penalty before.
That's well said. I mean, keeping an open mind in journalism, especially in opinion,
right,
is important.
And I was like, when someone comes in, like when Governor Rauner came in, I said, okay, I don't see what he sees. Well, I don't see what he's going to do. He hasn't said, but I'm going to give him a chance. I felt that way about Donald Trump a little bit, although I had such misgivings about the way he ran his campaign and the way he ran his transition and then his inaugural speech, that it was really, really hard to say, okay, now I'm going to give him another chance. But, you always have to have an open mind that things are, just because he does something doesn't mean that it's necessarily bad. Probably, but not for sure. And the same thing, I think with all kinds of political figures out there, you have to say like, well, let's look at this on its own merits. Let's not try to prejudge everything that's said or done. So,
I started the interview talking about what Chicago was like 30 years ago. When you have 30 years as writing a column, sort of being the heartbeat for the city and for its current events, what do you think of the biggest change has been from Chicago then to Chicago now?
Well, just in terms of the media, just to get back to this interactivity, this sense that we don't have, these big voices anymore. And you can't talk about writing a column in Chicago without talking about Mike Royko, who died, 20 years ago, I believe. In fact, was it 20 years ago?
Just last week.
Yeah. People talk about, okay, well, can anyone replace Royko? I don't think it's a knock on anyone to say that, no, I don't think anyone's going to replace Royko or ever could replace Royko, because newspaper columnists just aren't as important as they were in terms of, you don't have these people sitting astride a city anymore. And that's not just true in Chicago. I think it's true everywhere that there's too many different media sources. People have too many different, pipes coming into their homes. Too many different people have platforms, which is good. I think it's not good for those of us who want to sit astride the city, I suppose. But I think that, having a lot of a variety of voices, a lot of people who have the opportunity to address people. You know, and the great thing about the internet and blogs and all this stuff is that, you know, if you write something good, there's this, you know, this site Medium. Every once in a while, someone will write a post on Medium, which is essentially mm-hmm. this blog site, and it'll just go everywhere. And so someone who's just sitting at his desk typing out something or sitting in a coffee shop suddenly has had a huge impact. And that's a wonderful thing. And that's changed Chicago and it's changed the city. And you know, so when you have issues like, just to get back to this Orlando Cruz case, there's this, you know, this ability that I had to talk about this without really getting a lot of, you know, feedback, critical feedback. And now, you know, you write something in the morning and in the afternoon, people are second guessing you. But I think that's good. I really do. And it's invigorating for the craft of column writing. So
Eric Zorn, the Chicago Tribune columnist, celebrating 30 years as a columnist at the Chicago Tribune. Eric, here's to 30 more.
Huh? 30 more? I don't know about that.
Thanks.
Yeah, that's right. That'll
do. Thanks for being my guest tonight. I appreciate it, man.
It's been a lot of fun.